Good morning, everybody. We'll call to order both the regular and supplemental meetings, and we'll first thing recess the supplemental meeting. So what we'd like to do first is have a moment of silence in memory of our members and pensioners who have passed away over the last month. Thank you. First order of business is the consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag in that?
I just wanted to note that as we told you, we're seeing an uptick in retirements with people hitting their 10-year eligibility. We have actually 21 retirements on this agenda. We had 21 in May as well, but before that, we didn't exceed 20. Last time we did 20 was up for 2019, so we're seeing a little bit of an uptick, which we expect to continue. But other than that, nothing's unusual on the agenda.
Is there anything about that that is any catalyst that was it's more acute now than it was before, or is it just sort of the age of people and their tenure and sorts of things?
They had a big hiring surge 20-ish years ago, 20, 30 years ago. So, and we've known this, that we are now seeing about twice the number of people hit their 10 years, their retirement eligible, and their 10 years in drop. So we kind of expected this group of people to uptick.
And then also we have the minutes from the last meeting. We need to approve those first. Are there any comments or questions on those?
Motion to approve.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second. Ken.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Anyone opposed?
Aye.
Okay, the motion carries. And then the consent agenda. Do we have a motion to approve that?
Motion.
Okay, Mondo. Second?
Second. Tina.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the consent agenda is passed. So we now go to public comment. Do we have anyone from the public who would like to say anything?
So press 5-star on the phone. I'll unmute them.
Doesn't seem like we have anyone wanting to speak.
I don't see anybody.
Okay. All right. So now we'll go to the next item, item C1. We're going to talk about the actuarial valuation assumptions.
Great. On slide 17 in your diligent package is the updated information that Siegel requests. That Siegel provided based on our request. So just to remind you, we've talked about the assumption to use for the discount rate and the assumed rate of return at the last two board meetings. We're currently at 7%, so we're looking to either keep it at 7, lower it to 6.75 or 6.5. And in the prior two meetings, we looked at a report that was prepared by Siegel based on the 2020 audited financial results, because that's the most current audited numbers that we had. At the last meeting, it was requested that we provide Siegel an estimate of where we think we might end 2020. So we're actually, I'm a year off. The last numbers were based on the 1/1/20 valuation, which is the 2019 numbers. We're currently in the process of the 2020 audit, which will be used for the next valuation. We are waiting on final numbers from one material private equity company. So we don't have those finalized. We don't have the audit finalized. Typically, we don't go through the expense to have Siegel run an estimate until we get those final numbers in, because they basically have to redo everything anyway once the numbers are finalized. But we went ahead and asked them to prepare an estimate so the board could take a look at the impacts based on the current numbers we have. So this estimate is based on unaudited financial data, preliminary results. Most all of the results are what we believe they will be, except for that one private equity firm. And we've kept that number of what the book value currently is. I had actually asked Eagle to run at both that number and at zero, but they weren't able to do both in the time frame that they had. So this number is with it at the current book value. They weren't able to do the zero. So what these results show is the preliminary January 1, 2021 valuation numbers. So that is the first column you see here, and if you look at the top line, it shows our accrued liability to be $4.857 billion. There is not the 2020 column on here, but just as a reference, that number was $4.72 billion. So it's up about $150 million, $130 million from the prior valuation with no change. That preliminary column is at the 7% discount rate. If you go down to the bottom, the funding ratios change from the 2020 valuation on line 9, the actuarial value of assets was 45.7%. Under the new estimate, it will be 43.53%, so down about 2%, which is less than was expected. And then on the market value basis, it goes from 43.5 to 38.6, and that's right in line what they projected last year when you saw the valuation. So we're basically, with the 7%, right in line with what Siegel estimated for the prior year, and that would have put the funding level at 2079, or the full funding year at 2079, which is a four-year increase from the 2020 valuation. If we lower the discount rate, you can see how it changes both the total accrued liability on line one and the funding percentages of the years to fund under both of those scenarios. Are there questions?
Yeah, Kelly, I think that maybe one of you could just sort of frame that what is the propriety of 6.5 versus 7? So this is the math that flows out of it. What is the rationale? What is the common sense points you would make saying why 6.5 would be more appropriate than 7, or other than that's where other people are? I mean, we can do that, but what's the underlying rationale for it?
Well, the underlying rationale is the capital market assumptions for all of the asset classes from all of the consultants that are out there that do this are consistently going down over time. And that is why everybody is kind of lowering theirs. Is the inflation assumption is expected to remain low. It is difficult, however, to say what is the right number, because you're guessing for 30 years out. Is it going, what's going to happen? I don't know what's going to happen next year, more or less 25, 30 years from now. So it's hard to say if 6.75 is right, 6.5, 7 is right. But what we do know is our portfolio is challenged more than some, and it's going to remain challenged over some period of time. And to make up for those lower years, it is, and still return the discount rate that we select, we're going to have to achieve higher than that to make up for those lower years in the front end. So for us, because of our challenging portfolio, it seems logical to kind of err, if we're erring one way or the other, to choose a lower number. But that being said, one of the things I wanted to say for anybody that's listening is, this number, and you all know this number doesn't change how much money we have. We have how much money we have. What it changes is how we view the soundness of the plan. So whether we pick a low number or a high number, it doesn't change the reality. It changes our picture of the reality. So in my mind, I would prefer to have, more of a conservative picture and try to solve for, maybe the potential reality, than be overly optimistic and shoot for a lower solution that might not actually solve it.
Yeah. And then in addition, that going from 7 to 6.5 relative to any kind of labeling of the health of the plan, like for instance, we have that in the legislation, I think in 2023, there's a certain threshold. There's nothing about this that takes us across any threshold where we would have a certain letter or grade associated with the health of the pension that would be different if we went from 7 to 6.5. Is that correct?
That is correct, and it's, yeah, that's important to point out that when the legislation was passed in 2017, even on that day that the legislation was passed, we did not meet the funding requirements of the Pension Review Board. And the actuarial evaluation information that was prepared by Siegel and the PRB reviewed that information, showed that the plan would dip down and get worse before it would get better. And we've done that. And we're basically...
Kelly, what was the rate at that time?
What was the rate? It was 7.25.
Yeah, okay.
And we lowered it to 7, which moved us a little to the left, I guess you'd say, you know, lower funded than we expected to be, but we're still on the same path. I mean, and both of these numbers, if you go to the next page, I mean, you get to full funding. So this on this chart, the, I guess I can look on mine and read it better. So the light blue line is the city's hiring plan, and those were those estimates that were done in 2017 that Siegel always uses to project the employee contributions going out and the employer contributions. The black line is the projected payroll line, and that's basically taking where the actual contributions are coming in now and projecting those out. I feel comfortable that the hiring plan is probably the better number at this point because of the raises that have been done by the city, the hiring efforts that look like they're going to continue. So either way, if you look at either of these lines, the top line is, the top set is the 7%, the middle is 6.75, and the bottom is 6.5. And you can see the impact that, you know, we're still going to dip down, and it's just how far you go and how long you kind of stay down before you, you turn up. That's the difference.
Yeah, I think that it's, yeah, the next page, I think, is helpful just to see a number where,
right,
if it's 6.5, we're at 41%, more or less, at the first of 2021, that dips down to 25. So, and that the trajectory of that dip is, unless something significant, unless there's a significant capital infusion, that's kind of math right now, or that's actuarial. There's not a whole lot that we can do about that unless we somehow, you know, created investments that defied any sort of norms in terms of returns or something like that. So that it's good that everyone understands what the riverbanks look like that we're dealing with, and we're talking about how we define and label and measure those riverbanks, but yet they are what they are.
One other legislative statutory point I would note, like just kind of from what you just said, Nick, is that, you know, the statute requires a supermajority for, I mean, not that the board indicated an interest in doing it anyway when you've done asset allocation, but, you know, to allocate and to get into alternative investments, which have the higher returns anyway, you know, requires a supermajority in any event for the board to, you know, to opt into any specific one. So there's a statutory push towards a more conservative allocation in any event.
Yeah, I think we're going to stay off that island maybe for a while. You know, have some nice parts of it, but there's some rugged terrain there too.
And so, you know, to more clearly answer your question, we're still in the same category of plans with problems, I guess I want to say, in the PRB, whether we change this or not. And we've been in that same situation since the bill was passed. So it doesn't change any thresholds, which is really your direct question.
So is staff's recommendation that we go from 7 to 6.5?
That, yes, that's my recommendation. And it's because of our assets, because of the uncertainty of the future, but also because we have this 2024 look coming up, and I know the mayor has a committee looking at things, and if we're going to solve the problem, I want to make sure we have the best view of the problem going into that.
Does anyone have any thoughts or comments they want to share?
Yes, this is Rod French. Kelly, quick question for you. What about 6.25?
6.25 is certainly an option. I can tell you, if I can find the sheet. We didn't have Siegel run this based on the new, the preliminary numbers, but the change was about, you know, 1.1% if we go down to 6.25. So that was, not being an actuary, but just looking at the numbers, the trend of the numbers, that would put our funding level at, on the right page here, on a market value of assets, about 35%. You know, and the actuarial value of assets is higher, but I tend to look at the market value. So that's certainly an option.
Do you think that is a realistic number based on how poor performing our private equity investments have been doing and how tough it's been to kind of shift out of those?
You know, again, it's hard to say 6.25 versus 6.5, but to me that seems a little too conservative only because we are seeing a pretty good uptick in the amount of private assets that we've been able to liquidate in 2021. Obviously, 2020, a lot of that didn't happen because of everything going on in the world, but we are getting through some of those assets. It's taking longer than we expected, but I think I would still recommend the 6.5 at this point. We can always lower it in the future.
And I think also that this number is meant to represent a very long-term view of sort of the structural opportunity set of returns more than kind of where you currently are at this moment, particularly when you're in the process of adjusting where you are and not to get ahead, but I think there actually is some good news within the overall news on investment performance that we'll get into later.
And just so you know, in the 99 plan universe that the PRB reports on, there are currently 11 plans under 6.5 and 10 plans between 6.5 and 7. And 24 plans, which is where we're counted, at 7. And then the rest are above 7.
Hey, Nick?
Yeah.
It's Gilbert. I'd like to make a quick comment, which is I want to just reiterate one more time what you said for the retirees to know that this is not changing the health of the plan at all, that it's just really getting a more realistic view of where market rates are. That's all it really is. And so they should not read anything into it. I think going to from 7 to 6.5 is a good move. I think it's substantive enough to matter, and that's the real key, is a substantive enough of a move to matter. I would support 6.25. I don't think it's really necessary. I think 6.5 is a pretty good move for another move.
Well, you know, the implications of 6.5 are something relative to, you know, viewing what is the overall health. It isn't necessarily, you know, what your heart rate is today, but it does project on where your health is headed if you don't, you know, make other changes perhaps. So, you know, I agree with you to a point. I think it does it does reflect, I think that the feeling of Kelly and staff is that it's the best reflection of the balance of today versus tomorrow on the health of the plan versus sticking with 7%.
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things that we can do is paint a very realistic picture of where we're at and where we're headed. Transparency and honesty goes a long way in the police and fire department. We've had way too many years of let's kick the can down the road and we'll figure it out later. So I think this is a good move. I could support 6.5.
Okay, any other comments? So do we have a motion?
I have a recommended motion at the bottom of this discussion sheet. You would just need to substitute in the percentage that you would want for the assumed rate of return, but we need to direct Siegel on all of the assumptions that we talked about a couple of months ago, as well as this.
I'll make a motion to 6.5. This is Gilbert.
And I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries.
Thank you.
All right, Ryan.
Sir, can you guys hear me all right on the phone? Take that as a yes. Start with an executive summary on the portfolio update. As has been for the last couple of years, the top focus is the liquidation of the private market assets. We've gotten $77 million back year to date, which is more than double all of 2020. Looking ahead in August, we have two large Dallas-based real estate investments we're expecting to close with proceeds in excess of $50 million coming back to us. Had a little bit of a surprise to the upside on pricing for one of them, about 10% above carrying value and expectations going into the process. So great news there. When we come back and talk to you guys quarterly about the private asset cash flows and we talk about the lumpiness that we see there, just to point that out, I mean, we had less than $200,000 in distributions come back in July, and we're talking about $50 million plus probably coming back in August. So just keep in mind what we have coming back looking forward, it's going to be quite lumpy in large chunks at a time. Moving ahead to the what's on the rest of the agenda for today, the board approved the long-term asset allocation in July, and we're going to be looking at a red line to the investment policy statement to implement the new long-term asset allocation and make some tweaks to the rebalancing and implementation sections there. As part of that new long-term asset allocation, we initiated some rebalancing activity last month, regular $16 million a month withdrawals from the safe reserve in the short-term core bond portfolio, and that will get us to that new 9% target by the end of the year. And then at the end of July, we funded $10 million each into global equity, EM equity, and EM debt in equal amounts as we talked about with the implementation plan. Going forward through the rest of this year, typically we had done, you know, 2 to 3 rebalancing activities per year, but based on the reduction to the safety reserve, it's going to be likely a monthly thing once we get money coming back from safety reserve and money coming back in from the private markets portfolio. On the new manager search processes, we launched the initial steps in the international ex-U.S. small cap search. And then Eastern Shore, who you guys approved last month, the contract is complete there, and we're looking to likely fund initial amounts once we get the proceeds back from those two sales that I mentioned earlier. Moving ahead to page 24, diligence. This is the public markets performance snapshot that we added last month. These assets, which is public equity and fixed income, ex cash, make up 2/3 of the portfolio. So this is the part of the portfolio that you guys, we really have control over right now. We're looking at prior month and year-to-date performance. Overall, the total public portfolio returned 8.5%, which is 1.5% in excess of a 60-40 benchmark proxy there. The two growth-tilted equity managers exceeded their benchmark quite a bit in July. So with that, all four active managers are now outperforming year to date, which is good news. you can see with their emerging market equity, they're down 6% in July. So a lot of that was COVID fears and then China regulation driving that. And then looking at fixed income, the benchmark is negative for the year, but our assets have been protective with a slight positive return year to date. Asset allocation, this is updated for the new targets. Right now we sit at 13% in the safe reserve or $265 million as compared to the new target of $180 million. On the detailed asset allocation, just a few things to point out. On this slide on 26, we're just above $2 billion and we've been sitting at or above right around that level most of the year, so that's a good proxy to see kind of how performance has been trending year to date, knowing that we got 6% of the portfolio leaving the plan annually. Private markets with adjustments are at $620 million, or 31% of the plan, as compared to the target of 15. And then in the middle of the page at the bottom, you see we're still taking that $46 million adjustment on the private equity portfolio. We expect that to, been saying it for a few months, but hopefully get pushed all the way through to the book and stop making that adjustment going forward. Any questions there?
Well, a couple things jump out at me just when I kind of assess this is that this allocation, if you exclude the private, is about, and I'm looking at the number that's the 8.4% on slide 3, that's roughly two-thirds of the entire portfolio.
Correct.
And our target allocation is that this would represent 85% of mm-hmm. the whole portfolio. So we still have a transition of about 20% of the portfolio, hopefully out of privates, into this allocation, which at least on a year-to-date basis we see is performing well, that asset allocation works, good, solid, fundamental manager selection into the proven asset classes is works, and that's really, really good news. We had, because of our situation going back a couple years, we played defense with the safety reserve, and you know the safety reserve is a extraordinary act. It's not something you do in normal course. Now, like we've seen in COVID, we get used to a lot of things that are extraordinary measures, and then when they go away or you change them, it feels different. So what we're really doing here is we're reducing the safety reserve by a pretty significant amount because we are going into what we hope is sort of a normal investment mode long-term going forward where we have a good, solid, fundamental asset allocation. And at the same time, we're working through methodically going through our private assets, generating value where we can, acknowledging that in many of these we're LPs where we do not have the right to trigger liquidity unless we are willing to accept some very significant discount, and we're just taking it issue by issue, day by day. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Correct.
Yeah. And then with all that, you know, my understanding is that we're about $9 million of negative cash flow per month in terms of contributions versus payout with not due regard to any investment return.
Yeah, that's how we've been trading for the last year plus. We expect it to increase a little bit over time, but we're watching it closely.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things. They're all a bunch of gears. They're all working independently and in sync with each other, all to kind of a general purpose. Does anyone have any kind of thoughts or comments or see it differently or any aspect of it they want to discuss with the group? Because this has been an area of extraordinary chaos in the past. I mean, really extraordinary. And you can start to see a real plan that can work and hopefully will stand the test of time going forward. And I think it's really important that we all see it, understand it, question it where possible, but that we all are working from the same sheet of paper.
Yeah, I mean, that two-thirds of the portfolio that we control that you talked about, I mean, that was well below 50% two-plus years ago. So we're growing that side of the portfolio, building it out.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that as we whittle down to a smaller and smaller percentage of the portfolio, it's going to become incredibly, increasingly hard to dispose of these assets, or at least to try and get them from private to public.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of like we kind of have this, okay, this is so much percentage of the fund. We want to do this within this time frame. But realistically, I think that, you know, it's just this gradient effect. As we get less and less, those are going to be the more troubled assets that have been a problem to dispose of anyway. And those are the ones that are potential write-offs. I mean, am I wrong to think that? I mean,
I think just from a math standpoint, if we're selling 20% of the portfolio every year and that's leading to, you know, $100 million in distributions, as that remaining portfolio shrinks, you have to sell a higher percentage to keep up that pace. Some of the amounts that are going to take a longer time to sell are the bigger funds, the HUFs, and those should come back all at once, not knowing, you know, what value they're going to return. But yes, I think we've kind of, as we've gone through quarterly and looked at the forward projections, we've been pushing some of those out a little bit, knowing that, you know, even when we get below the 15% or to the 15% target, we're probably going to still have a few of the legacy assets that you know, we had hoped to be gone on the books at the end of 2023. Okay. We added this periodic table of asset class returns a couple months ago. One interesting thing to point out here, on the year-to-date, the two highest returning asset classes are REITs and commodities. And then if you look at 2020, those were the two lowest returning asset classes. So just indicates the cyclicality of the markets. Looking at the quarterly plan, a lot of this is what we've been talking to you guys about, but IPS update today to reflect the new asset allocation. Launched the international small cap search. We're in process right now doing a global equity structure review. We'll talk about that a little bit in the IPS, but this is a study that looks at how do we want to allocate that 55% to global equity. So we have a draft right now. I'm thinking we're probably going to take that to the IAC for review in September, then back to the board. And then we're internally re-underwriting the emerging markets asset class and manager there. Then board schedule, we have the infrastructure portfolio review this month, and then we start a review of the public asset classes in September and October. All right, if there's no other questions, I'll move ahead to the IPS red line. So we have a full red line version of the IPS investment policy statement starting on page 33, but we have a summary of changes, and then I'll go through this, point out the asset allocation appendix, and then see if there's any specific questions on it. Obviously, the primary major change is updating all the targets and ranges in the asset allocation appendix. Secondly, we removed the implementation plan appendix B1, which was the schedule that said, you know, as money is coming back from the private market portfolio, this is how we are going to invest it. Everything now flows through the rebalancing section according to the plan we talked to you guys about the last couple of months, with equal amounts going into global equity, EM equity, and EM debt until those are fully allocated. Change all the references to the safety reserve from 2.5 years or 30 months down to the current 18-month amount. So as I mentioned earlier, rebalancing activity can be a little bit more frequent through the end of the year with the safe reserve reduction. This section has always been a little bit confusing and vague to me, so we tried to add a little bit more specificity where we could. Added executive director approval of all rebalancing activities. That's how we've been operating for the last two to three years. But staff looks at it, makes a recommendation to Makita. Makita will give us their concurrence, and then Kelly will sign off on it. On the safety reserve, as Nick mentioned, we would use that in extraordinary times to pay benefits if there's market downturn or stress. We had a provision that we'll come back to the board and notify you guys if we've tapped into that 9% amount to pay benefits and are drawing it down actively. And then just added a clarification that all rebalancing activity will move an asset class towards the target. So we can't, you know, draw down on fixed income and add to equity tactically because we think it's the right thing to do. Everything is moving towards target. And then on the asset class structure provision, it just added a note that that only applies to asset classes with multiple managers within it. So really, that only applies to global equity right now. And we have a 55% target there. Our next largest asset class is a 6% target, so it makes sense that we want to take a more detailed look at equity and how we're going to allocate within that, you know, over half the portfolio target allocation. I'll flip ahead to 53 just to show you the red line on the asset allocation slide and then see if there's any questions on changes we're making here.
But the catalyst for the changes is really the reduction in the safety reserve and the reallocation of that to the other longer-term
mm-hmm. funds. Yeah, I mean, all this is driven by the asset allocation approved last month. So this is very hard to see, but new targets and ranges based on the updated allocation.
Any comments or questions? Can we have a motion to approve these changes to our investment policy statement?
So moved, Nick.
Second?
Second, Ken.
Second, Steve.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Brian? Thank you.
Infrastructure portfolio. We'll do a brief review of the infrastructure portfolio. Greg helps to oversee this portfolio, so he'll jump in. He's downstairs on the phone if there's any detailed questions, but we'll keep it pretty high level. So this is an asset class that the allocation was removed as part of the new asset allocation in 2018, so we have a target of zero. We got three remaining funds comprising of $48 million in AUM remaining here. They're all legacy J.P. Morgan funds. We think it's probably going to take three-plus years to get out of it in total. Slight good news for the year, the portfolio is up about 10% from the year in March. I'll move through into the fund detail. First one to talk about is J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund. This is our boat fund, 2019 vintage, name would indicate in the shipping industry. We had a $50 million commitment here. We currently have $28 million in NAV. Returns have not been great here. We're nearing the end of the fund life. We have 2 years left. The manager, J.P. Morgan, expects to be able to liquidate over the next 2 years. They came to us earlier this year with a proposal to get some near-term liquidity and then roll shifts into a new vehicle. And our feedback, and it seems like most of the other LPs, was no thank you, please sell everything right now over the next 2 years. So they sold five ships in Q1. We had about $2 million come back from that distribution. So the good news is slight uptick in valuation, and that's the first large distribution we've seen on this fund since 2016. So good market environment right now and should start seeing proceeds come back more regular from this fund going forward. All right, the next two sets of funds we'll talk about together are the Asian Infrastructure Funds, the Arrow Funds. These were originally managed by J.P. Morgan, and they came back to the LPs in 2018 just saying that they're getting out of the markets altogether. They didn't have the capabilities to manage it on a go-forward basis. So transferred to the Roten Group, or TRG, as a new GP. They've done a pretty good job refinancing some difficult assets within the portfolio the last couple of years, but they have yet to execute any sales in the portfolio. The Arrow One Fund, we had a $40 million commitment there, currently have $16 million in NAV. The fund term is coming up in about 6 months in January. It previously got extended by 2 years, so we're expecting another extension request coming up. As with the last one, we will look to push down fees as low as possible there. And the GP is saying that they're expecting to get to exits within a couple of years, but frankly, we think it's going to take a little bit longer there just based on the history of the fund and the difficulty taking some of that assets within it. And then the Arrow 2 fund, this was a predecessor fund to Arrow 1, also managed by TRG, one remaining asset that's co-owned with Arrow 1 within this portfolio, and our NAV there is only $4 million. So timing should be pretty similar to Arrow 1.
Yeah, and these are classic examples of decisions that were made, 10-plus years ago, tied up $90 to $100 million of the capital of the pension. Here we are 10, 12 years later, and we're not going to get our principal back, so everything else has to carry it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a classic example of what we want to get away from. And you can see with the GP here, they're not able to earn the pref, therefore they're not going to get any performance fees. All they're going to get is their management fees. So they have disincentives, or not, they don't have incentives to kind of hang in there and fight and try to maximize because they've dug too big of a hole for themselves.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why JP Morgan walked away from the first Arrow funds. A little more optimistic on the Maritime Fund, just given the market environment. And just also mentioned we had the two direct toll road investments within the infrastructure portfolio that actually worked out pretty well, and we sold those on the secondary market in 2018, I believe.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thanks, Ron.
All right.
Kelly?
Okay, so on the contribution report, that is on slide 64. This is the report you see every month. This one's for August. It's based on June data. For the last pay period in June, there were 184 fewer employees on the payroll than the hiring plan estimate. Most of those were 211 of those were for police officers were under the estimate, and fire offset that because they had 27 more employees than the estimate had. This next page is the summary page. There were two payrolls in June, so for the month, those two payrolls, we received $11.4 million in actual contributions, which was lower, slightly lower than the floor. So the actual contributions were 97% of the floor, 105% of the hiring plan, and that's what I talked about earlier. The city has shown the willingness and the ability, and they've actually given a lot of raises, and they've really done a good job with their hiring since 2017, which is good. Since the bill was put into place, we have would have received actual contributions of $514.5 million, but because the floor was in place, we received an extra $41 million since the inception of the bill because of the floor. So things are on track, and they appear to be continuing that way. Hopefully the hiring will keep up with the increased retirement, so we'll see. But it looks like the city's committed to doing that. Are there any questions about city contributions? And I would note, you probably saw this, in the paper, the city manager's proposed budget includes 250 new police officers and more money for fire. And I don't know if those more money, the more money for fire for people, two people?
Oh, no. I think that's together.
Oh, okay.
If you're talking about the proposed salary increases, that's tied to both police and fire. But the increase in budget allocation, that's for some specific programs that we have going on within fire.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So all that's positive for us.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you. On the next item, is it all right if I move to that?
Yes.
Okay. The trustee education item, there are three classes listed on this agenda, two NCBRS classes and a TexBRS class. No trustee has asked to attend, so we don't need a motion unless somebody wants to attend one of these or add a class to the list. And since I'm not hearing any, I'm assuming we don't need a motion for that.
The only thing I would say is that, you know, that I really would encourage everyone, and I, you know, and I myself struggle with this at times. If you look at that sheet that we did, that Siegel prepared, that was the 7 to 6.5, I think that we all should really try to understand what each of those terms mean. And, you know, if there is anything that's, you know, kind of more of a tutorial that Siegel has or something that's really kind of on point to that with definitions and, you know, kind of actuarial valuations for dummies type things, I think that all of us having a base level of competence in, you know, the major terms of the actuarial side is just something that it would just, you know, information and wisdom would flow better if we all shared a good baseline understanding of all those. And I just know personally, I've really had to kind of spend a lot of time figuring some things out. I don't know that I really am super comfortable with my knowledge of every term. And so I just encourage people on that. And Kelly, anything that you guys would have. And once again, if it's something that's 100 pages long, you know, that's too much. But if there's something that was short, concise, that is a good glossary, anything like that that Siegel might have, I doubt all their directors understand all the terms all the time. So maybe they prepared something for their people over time. It'd be good to have that. I don't know if anyone else shares that little bit of a struggle.
Well, I think that's actually a really good point, Nick. One of the things that we've lost with kind of the budget situation, but also because the board we have is a much different board and you're all busy, and we don't do the annual workshops anymore. So they used to, before 2017, have an annual workshop, which was, you know, several days long. They would go away, and then the actuary would come in and as part of that do kind of some nuts and bolts training. And I could have Siegel put together something that hopefully isn't as dry as most actuarial training, you know, but just talk to you about those terms, how they work, what really matters, and slide that into an agenda that is kind of a wider agenda. So it wouldn't be September, October. I know those are busy, but it'd certainly do something like that.
And something to piggyback on Nick's, you know, at some point we're all going to roll off this board, right? And to groom our, as part of our succession planning, mm-hmm. there may be some people within the police department and fire department that we could start training to understand this so that when they do get on the board, they're not having such a huge learning curve.
Right. There is a free education session for on the PRV website just on actuarial, too. I think it's an hour and 15 minutes or something like that if you haven't done it, but definitely do that. Okay.
Hey, Kelly.
Yes.
Hey, this is Ken. Opal Funds is having their, I think it's called the Public Funds Summit in Austin next month. If you want to get Carol to look at that, I believe it's free for trustees. I mean, of course, the cost will be a travel. It'll be in Austin. It'll be at the same hotel that TexBRS had their annual conference. So Opal, I mean, it's a little bit different than TexBRS and NCBRS. So if anyone would be interested in that, she can look into that and put that on the education portion of the agenda.
Okay. Ken, do you happen to know if that's before or after the next board meeting?
I believe it starts right around when NCBRS is, the fall conference is around September 26th.
Okay, good. So we'd have time to get approval for that.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Kelly, anything else from you?
No.
Okay. Brenda?
It's like the Olympics with the flicker.
Oh,
Thank you, Nick. This morning I'm going to review the second quarter financials. I'm going to start the review with the bridge chart. The bridge chart represents the changes in net positions over the period by adjusting for investment, benefit, and operations-related transactions during the period to arrive at an ending net position. So we began the year with a net position of $2.019 billion. We had investment-related transactions so far in 2021 that increased the net position by $101 million, and benefits and operations-related transactions that decreased the net position by $54 million. So our 6/30/2021 preliminary net position is $2.066 billion, and that is up $47 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I briefly want to just discuss some highlights from the financials. So the combined statements of fiduciary net position, this report compares the June 30th, 2021 results to the preliminary results from December 31st, 2020. And the first section on this statement is investments. Total investment value at June 30th was $1.98 billion, and that compares to $1.916 billion at 12/31, or an increase of almost $65 million. And the two largest components of the change in investments were equity securities and real assets. Equity securities increased by $105 million during the first half of the year. You may recall that in March and April of this year, the passive global equity mandate was funded with Northern Trust, and we had redemptions from Boston Partners, Manulife, Walter Scott, and Invesco, along with some additional cash, which were used to fund the Northern Trust account. Real assets declined by $56 million during the first half of the year. But that's related to sales of property. So AEW, we received a distribution from them of $25.4 million for the sale of Camel Square self-storage. And we also received a $9.6 million RCH loan repayment. From Hearthstone, we received $15.4 million for the sale of Spring Valley. And we had other sales of Forest Investments, sold San Pedro, the San Pedro property. We received distributions from Clarion of $4.5 million. And as Ryan mentioned earlier, a distribution from J.P. Morgan Maritime of 1.8. And then there were also valuation changes that contributed to this change in real assets. As we move down the page into receivables, we see that city and member contributions receivables decreased over the period. And that's primarily related to the number of days that are accrued at the end of the month and an increase in the per-day average payroll. We accrued 8 days in June, and in December we accrued 9 days. As we continue to move down the page, we see that cash decreased by $14 million since year-end. And that decrease in cash is related to cash that we used for rebalancing and also to pay payments, to pay benefits during the period. As we move down into the payable section and we look at AP and other accrued liabilities, we see that they declined by $481,000 since the end of 2020. And the decrease in the accrual for management fees, which was $692,000, was partially offset by increases in refunds payable, uncompensated absences, accrual for the staff, and accrued liabilities. Next, I want to look at the changes in fiduciary net position. This statement compares the results from June 30th, 2021 to the results from June 30th, 2020. The first section is contributions. City contributions increased by almost $1.6 million year over year, and the increase in city contributions is due to the floor increase from $5.724 million per pay period last year to $5.882 million per pay period this year. And the total increase that is related to the floor increase is $2 million. And that increase was partially offset by accrual changes year over year. Overall, member contributions increased by $979,000. Year over year. That's primarily due to salary increases. Regular member contributions increased $1.4 million. However, a decline in drop contributions and year over year accrual changes partially offset this increase. The employee headcount, I think it's interesting to note, has declined by 269 when compared to June of last year. As we move down into the investment section, we see that net investment income increased by $149 million year over year. Net appreciation and depreciation increased by $151 million year over year, and the increase was primarily driven by changes in equity, which was up $120 million, real assets, which were up $23 million. Fixed income was up $4.3 million and private equity up $1.1 over the prior year. As we move to interest and dividends, they're down $380,000 due to declines in both short and long-term interest income, which was down $2.6 million year over year. This decline was partially offset by increases in dividend income and real assets income. As we move down into the deduction section, the first item is benefits. Benefits paid to members increased by $2.3 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $2 million, and survivor benefits increased by $429,000. These increases were partially offset by declines in disability payments of $93,000. And new service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver of the increase in the benefits paid to members. We move to the next section. We see legal expense. Legal expense has declined $128,000 year over year. That's due to the resolution of some cases in 2020, as well as the timing of some expenses this year. Staff expenses have decreased by $81,000 year over year, and that's primarily due to three vacant staff positions. And then finally, as we look at professional and administrative expenses, they have increased by $36,000. I'm sorry, they have decreased by $36,000 when compared to the same period last year. And it's a mix of increases in legislative consultants, risk insurance, communications, increases there being offset by other items like the actuarial expense. Last year we had the experience study, which it did not repeat this year, so that actuarial expense is down $72,000, along with other items that are related to the timing, audit expense, security expense. Are there any questions about the financials?
I would like to ask that we go back to the first slide, 72, where we have the bar chart?
Yes.
I always think it's important that we sort of celebrate small victories. If one were to just look at this chart without awareness of our accrued liability or whatever, you would say this has a lot of healthy attributes to it. Yes, you would probably like the benefit contributions to be closer to what the outflows are, particularly if you have a city that's growing. You know, if this were a city on the decline, that maybe would make a little more sense. But if you have a city that's growing, you'd like to see those numbers be closer together. But the fact that it was depreciation of investment for a long time, and that second bar chart that's positive, the $91 million, this really is in context of a six-month period. This actually has a lot of elements of good health to it. And, you know, that's not to say, let's just look at this and ignore the Mount Vesuvius of accrued liability we have hanging over our heads, which we do need to deal with. But I think it is important to see that notwithstanding those long-term structural mountains we have to somehow navigate, there is a lot of good stuff here happening. And if you go just then two slides forward, where you have the numbers that show the combined statements of changes in fiduciary net position, you can just notice that on the six-month basis, this year, it's up $50 million, so $48 million, whereas in the same period last year, it was down $100 million. So that meant most likely that there were not as much investment gain or negative investment gain, or there was a bigger gap between cash coming in and cash going out. I don't recall exactly what the chart looked like then. But I just think it's important to know that, you know, kind of all the work to date, notwithstanding the bigger issues, there's a lot of really good stuff going on. And we should be just as aware of that as we are. And it really speaks to, first and foremost, staff. I think it speaks to, you know, incredible leadership that Bill provided us for many years. And, you know, we'll have other challenges going together. We've had pretty good tailwinds in terms of overall markets, but we really have made a lot of great progress.
Thank you, Nick. I'll finish off the section on financials by looking at the net benefit shortfall chart. This chart graphically represents the shortfall between benefit contributions and benefit payments. Benefit payments in the last quarter remained steady at $81 million. Benefit contributions were $56 million, and the average shortfall in the second quarter was $8.4 million. And I do want to note that this chart includes only benefit payment and contribution transactions and doesn't include any cash inflow or outflow related to the system. So this is pure contributions in, benefits paid out.
So we're negative eight point four
on average.
On average.
For the last quarter. And you can see the improvement. It starts in 2017, so you can see the improvement there as we close that gap a little bit and reduce that that average monthly shortfall. But it's been remaining pretty steady here. Benefit payments kind of creeping up a little bit, but remaining fairly steady here over the last few quarters. Any other questions on the financials?
Budget now?
If not, we will move on to looking at the budget. So this is the mid-year budget review. And during this review, we're going to look at the actual versus budget results for administrative, professional, and investment expenses for the first 6 months of 2021. This first schedule shows account names, along with the 2021 actual, 2021 budget, and 2020 actual balances along with their variances. As we go through the presentation, we will examine some of the largest variances in more detail. Generally, some of the reasons for the variances include that the budget is created on an annual basis and then straight-lined over the year. Some expenses are heavier in the earlier part of the year, for example, payroll taxes, thus creating a negative variance in the first half of the year, but they're typically then within budget by the end of the year. Also, some expenses come in a lumpier fashion, with large invoices that cover a period or a project, like IT projects or audit fees. And finally, COVID-19 is still creating some variances with either less expense than forecast, because our premise for 2021 was that things would return to normal, and things have not quite done that yet. So you'll see that in things like board or staff travel or conferences or with delay in some of the expenses. This schedule is sorted by the highest over budget variance to the highest under budget variance. And if you'll look about three-fourths of the way down the page, you'll see a line titled Gross Total. And in the next to the last column, you will see that on an overall basis, the administrative and professional expenses are $682,000 under budget. And at the bottom of the page, you will see that the investment expenses are $1.4 million over budget, and we'll discuss that in more depth as we go through the presentation. For admin and professional expenses, our highest over budget item is legislative consultant fees, and our highest under budget item is legal fees. And on the next page, we'll look at line items that had a variance that's greater than $10,000 and 5% from their budget. So we have two items that meet that criteria and are over budget. The first item is legislative consultant fees that are $15,000 over budget. And this variance is related to the timing of expenses. The legislature was in session through June initially. Now they've had some special sessions. And expenses are higher during the legislative session. But the budget is straight-lined over the year, and we expect to be within budget by the end of the year. The next item is communications expense for phones and internet. It's $11,000 over budget. We had an increase, price increase for the analog lines that primarily service the building or are related to the building, like fax lines and call boxes. We're in the process now of deactivating these lines where that's viable, or porting them to new services like analog emulator ports to reduce the cost and get it back in line. Now, as we move to the next section and we look at administrative and professional items that are under budget, the first item is legal fees, $271,000 under budget. Again, the variance is related to the, in part to the timing of some of the expenses that are happening more in the second half of the year as opposed to the first half, as well as fewer case expenses than we forecasted. Salaries and benefits are $103,000 under budget. We're lower than our forecasted expenses due to, in part, to the three vacant staff positions that I mentioned earlier and one budgeted but unfilled position for a communications specialist. The next item is information technology projects. It's $74,000 under budget. This is an item where the budget is, again, straight-lined over the year, and we've had some project start dates delayed related to COVID, that are pushing more of that expense in the second half. Liability insurance is $59,000 under budget. If you recall, last fall when we were creating the budget, we were looking at a variety of scenarios for our renewal. We budgeted an increase of 17.8% during those few ensuing months until February when we actually were renewing our policies. We did a significant amount of work at looking at the crime policy, reducing both our coverages there and increasing our coverages in our cyber, and then the projected increases in our fiduciary turned out to be less than were expected. So we budgeted a 17.8% increase in premiums, and we actually have a decrease of 2.1%. So we look at actuarial services. They're $54,000 under budget. That's due in part to the timing and quantity of specialized services that are required. I do expect in the second half of the year that those expenses will increase as we have utilized Siegel to look at possible changes to the assumed rate of return that we discussed earlier today. Other items, travel for the staff under budget, again, COVID-related, no one's really traveling. Independent audit, $18,000 under budget. That's related to the timing of expenses. We should be at budget by the end of the year. Conference training materials, $17,000 under budget. Due to COVID, we're not really attending any conferences or training. Pension administration, that's just, again, timing. We'll be using those funds later in the year, we believe. And then finally, network security monitoring. We were able actually to reduce the cost below our projection when we signed the contract. The final two items here are investment expenses. One item exceeded the budget, that is investment portfolio operating expenses, exceeded it by $1.8 million. This variance relates not only to the timing of some expenses, but we had unbudgeted Northern Trust transition costs when we funded the Passive Global initiative earlier, as well as some Lone Star costs that were not budgeted. We had an item that the fund management fees that are $415,000 under budget, and what you're seeing for fund management fees are direct fees only, not fees that are paid on this report, not fees that are paid through the funds. Due to timing, some of the performance fees are due and paid at the end of the year. Are there any questions about the budget? Budget actual comparison. Okay. If not, then Nick, it's okay. I'll move on to the next item, which is the audit update. So as has been previously discussed, we are still waiting on financial information for some of our funds. They are material to the pension system, and we cannot proceed with our audited financials without them. Once we receive those remaining financial information, then we'll be able to submit our information to the actuary. And once we do that, we believe that we'll have our audited financials completed in about 60 days. In the meantime, staff is still working on the audited, on the pieces of the financials, the audited financials that can be completed, notes 3 and 4, which are fairly large. And we're beginning work on the comprehensive annual financial report as well.
And is it Hoff and Lone Star of the two?
Correct.
And what deliverables do you have from them that give you a sense of when the timing might be?
From Hoff, nothing. We've reached out to them asking specifically and have received no answers as far as I'm aware. Correct. Lone Star is part of the legal process and part of the legal process.
Okay. The numbers that you use for 1/1/21 on things we've seen, we showed it was a $47 million.
46. That 40, adjustment, yeah.
Yeah. That was off what they gave you as a preliminary number for year end, or was it 46 off of what?
That's off their actual audited value. So the Lone Star audits are done. It's just getting the our internal valuation complete and to our auditors.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what are we using for HOP that's baked into those numbers?
So I use the book value, so it could be high. That's where I asked Eagle to run the what we currently have and zero, thinking it's going to be somewhere in between those. But the numbers that we talked about with the assumed rate of return was based on the, what we have the investment booked at now.
That's a 9/30 carried forward value.
Right.
9/30/2020.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And it's, that number swings every year pretty significantly.
82 to 1.
But the reality on that one is, unlike Lone Star, where we would bring in somebody else and do an evaluation, we just don't have enough data on us to do that.
Is there any communication at any level with HOP on any of this?
So this is the last two communications that happened with HOP. So they reached out 6 months ago, 9 months ago, something, and wanted to do an abbreviated version of the audit. And we said, no, not okay. And I think the other LPs must have as well, because we don't have a controlling interest. But he didn't do an abbreviated version. And that's all we heard until last week. We received a very short update on the fund. Didn't mention the audit at all. He sent it out to all the LPs. So when I got that, I replied back and said, what's the status of the audit? And I got word from his assistant, which is how the communication goes, that she would forward my email to Mr. Huff, and I've heard nothing back.
And we have no mechanism in place to, we have no leverage to get the information from them.
No, and we pressure every year since I've been here, and frankly, it's just gotten worse. It's not gotten better. They're supposed to have the audit done by, well, they're supposed to use their best efforts to get the audit done by the end of February. And so in the past, I've shown them how many days late they've been every year. On the alternative fund, they're actually just supposed to have it done. It's not a best efforts thing, but on the energy fund, which is where the value is, best efforts. So I've asked them, tell me what you're doing to show your best efforts. It's gone nowhere.
I mean, we've gone so far as to say, what's the schedule?
Right.
When are your auditors coming? When are you going through your process? When are you supposed to, you know, trying to put some kind of timeline together for them last year? And to no avail.
But it's another example of we're just living with decisions of the past. I mean, us investing such a large amount in one private equity portfolio that is material to us puts us in this boat. If it would have been a smaller investment and it wasn't, you know, the percentage of our portfolio it is, if we wouldn't have the issue. We could, the auditors would just say not material and move on. But, you know, the decisions from the past that we're living on.
What is the HOP NAV at 9/30/2020?
82 million.
82.
It's about 4% of the portfolio.
Okay, and then for Lone Star,
do you want to say that?
Yeah, I don't know if we want to say that. And okay,
I can write it down.
Okay.
Any other questions about the audit?
Great. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you.
Kelly, your executive director's report?
Yeah. So the newsletters, thank you. In your materials is the NCPRS monitor The Persist is listed here from NC Burs. However, that's not available yet. So when it is available, Melissa will email it to you all. The TechPERS is a link which is provided here. As far as open records requests go, I was hopeful that I was going to say we don't have any this month, but we received one yesterday. So we'll be working on that one. Office opening, we're really at the kind of same status as we were last month. Members can walk in and or have appointments here, and they've been doing that. Seems to be going well. The majority of people are still choosing to do things virtually, but it's really the members' choice. We have been doing virtual education sessions, received a lot of positive feedback from that. We are having an in-person meeting on Monday at 2 o'clock, which is in response to the request that you've heard from the police member that speaks sometime, and it's specifically in the format that officer asked for. So we're going to do a quick overview of the pension system, and again, we don't have final numbers yet, so the timing's a little bit awkward, and just talk about some high-level things, but the majority of the time will be for the members to ask questions about their benefits. And I know a lot of retirees want to come to this. It's not really geared for retirees because their benefits are set. Once we get final numbers, you know, we will do pension updates for everybody. But at this point, we're going to limit the capacity in the room to 50% of the capacity, which is about 40 people. We'll have staff, so not a whole lot of people can fit in that room. But you can join via Zoom. You can ask questions over Zoom if you'd like, so that's available too. And that information's on the website, right? The link, Melissa?
Okay. What trustees will be here? Who?
I believe it will be you, Tina, and Mark.
Okay.
Yeah. Just planning on
attending. What are the types of questions or feedback? What are the main issues on the minds of the beneficiaries and the contributors right now when they call? What are their main issues?
It really depends on who they are, like how, if they're retired, if they're, well, the brand new employees don't call. I was going to say if you're a brand new employee. But a lot of times, especially if you've been here over 5 years or 10 years, you're starting to get a little bit older and you wonder how do these benefits work, so you want to know how is the benefit calculated, what the member has asked for is, he's saying people want to know about drop. Well, drop is very different if you're a new employee or somebody in drop, and you know, it's not a good use of everybody's time to do the same kind of drop training. So I think generally they want, frankly, it's hard to generalize information because everybody's in such a different situation. So I always encourage people to call us. I mean, we're here to help you. We're here to answer questions. Armando gets a lot of calls. What are you hearing from your people, their general calls?
Overall health of the fund. Are we going to shut it down and start something new? What's the best retirement process for me? Which to my response to that is there's 10,000 members. There's 10,000 different situations.
Yeah.
There's not a one-size-fits-all. Those are the two big ones. Overall health of the fund. Are we going to shut it down? And then what are we doing to fix it? And, you know, my response to that typically is get online every month and you can hear a lot of the hard work that we're doing. How's the board functioning as a whole? I bet it's tough working with the mayor's people.
So that's kind of the general thing, and I'll talk with Armando and make sure we're hitting everything. The specific things they've asked for, getting back onto the agenda, it's like a kick, is, you know, the point of this item that we're talking about is to talk about this member meeting. So we're going to include some of those things. But the specific things that this one particular member asked for was help of the fund, exactly like you said, a little bit about drop, which I'm not really going to cover because it doesn't make sense. I'll talk about where they can find drop education. And they specifically want to know about the lawsuits that the funds involved with. So that's basically going to be the and then questions. The last thing that I have is the CIO recruitment. We 78 applications, and I'm in the process of scheduling it, first-round calls with some of those people. That's what I have there.
Hey, Kelly?
Yes?
It's Gilbert. I just wanted to chime in that the thing I hear from retirees is, and it's kind of to Nick's point, they often aren't aware or aren't fully knowledgeable on some of the language we use. And so maybe there some type of primer that's broadcast online about what does the funded ratio mean? What does the actuarial return assumption really mean? And just a very basic primer that if people want to listen, that'd be great, because there's always just a lot of high anxiety. And so I think that might be something to look at.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
Kelly, I wanted to let you know that the NC First process became available a little bit ago and went ahead and uploaded it.
Oh, okay.
If you guys want to look at it.
Okay, great. If you didn't hear Melissa, she said that that persists document is now available on your diligence.
Okay. So I think we're now going to go into closed session.